This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. As you well know, this part of the program is called The Big Picture, where we try to make sense of a lot of the data blips that you see rolling by you today. A couple of years back, if you recall, we did a show entitled Megatrends, Large Trends and Changes That Would Reshape the Next Decade. And we have decided it's time to do an update of what we consider to be the seven megatrends of the next 10 years. Now, the ones we're going to cover today, I'll tell you what the list is here in a second. Some are the same as it was before, and some are different because things are changing rapidly. Technological innovation is accelerating every 7 years. There's a major rollover of sorts. I mean, think about what you have today that has reshaped the way we have lived. We've got smartphones, social media, electric cars, things that just didn't exist 7 to 8 years ago. And even before that, 7 years before that was another major rollover. So what are the trends? Okay, well, first of all, retailing ice age. The whole notion of how things are sold to the market is radically changing, and you're watching all of these retail stores that for 50, 60 years have been in business are having to scurry to stay afloat. Number two, automation and the death of routine jobs. Number three, reverse migration. This has nothing to do with America's immigration controversy. We're talking about movements toward the central corridor. And ironically, it's almost a revolution of sorts where people are leaving states with abusive taxation and moving to states with favorable taxation, including businesses. And of course, the people are following the business. Number four, reshaping energy and peak demand. Number five, education, technology, and the age of guilds. Number six, longevity and health, which are both interrelated issues and are changing the financial situation of many countries around the world. And finally, number seven, Orwell's world, referring, of course, to 1984 by George Orwell. Are we heading towards some form of totalitarianism, especially electronic totalitarianism? So we're going to cover those trends here today. Let's start with the retailing ice age, which is, I would say, Jim, self-evident to all but the most casual observer.
Well, I mean, it's obvious with the invention of the internet, the online success of Amazon. We've seen it year after year where more and more people are shopping online, and they're just taking a look at present trends. Retailing online sales by 2020 are going to go from $270 billion to $523 billion. That will be up 56% since 2015. So it just goes to show you how rapidly this is catching on. The average annual rate of growth for online retailing is going to average between 9 and 10% a year. Forrester Research just published a report, and they're basically saying in the next 4 years, we're going to see online retailing grow by 9.2%. And it's going to accelerate in the next decade to, it'll be right now, a $1 trillion business as a result of mobile phones. John, have you ever ordered anything through your smartphone? In other words, have you bought anything on Amazon or?
Yeah, I buy things on Amazon all the time.
Yeah, I can't tell you the number of times I will be sitting in my study at night and I'm reading something and I'm reading about a new book. I just whip out my little Amazon app, press a button, and boom, I'm ordering the book. And I tend to read hardcover books. And if I had a Kindle, if I really wanted it, I'd just press a button and I could download the book in a minute. But nonetheless, as more and more mobile devices get integrated in what we call Internet 3.0, you're going to see this trend of online retailing accelerate. Now, there are consequences for all of this, and we'll get into that in a moment. But let me just give you a couple statistics. In 2016, holiday sales, brick and mortar holiday sales were up 3.6%. So if you group everything, brick and mortar online, online sales were up 12%. During the holidays. And what's interesting is you analyze retailing statistics for 2016. there were 56.6 million shoppers to brick and mortar stores here in the U.S. There were 56.5 million shoppers online. So online shoppers is almost as great or equal to what we have seen with typical brick and mortar shopping. So once again, this trend is accelerating, and we'll get into shortly here what this is going to mean for investors, for retailing establishments, for commercial real estate, and some of the fallout and consequences of this trend.
I don't know if you're seeing this in your town, Jim, but we're seeing it here especially, that the shopping malls are, you know, which used to be the big place to go, especially around Christmas time or various times of the year, are having trouble keeping clients in there and all of the spaces rented. Some of the big ones, you know, JCPenney, Sears, and others still seem to be hanging on, but they have trouble. They're having trouble.
Well, it's amazing, because if we take a look at what we saw announced in the month of January, this is following the Christmas retailing season, which is, that's the make or break it season for most retailers. Macy's announced that they're going to be closing 100 out of their 730 stores, 68 stores in 2017. Sears and Kmart. Kmart is going to be closing 78 stores. Sears is going to be closing 26. A total between them over the next 2 years of 150 stores. JCPenney's has 1,000 stores. They haven't released how much they're going to be closing, but it could be over 100 stores. CVS Pharmacy is closing 70 stores in 2017. Limited closed all 250 stores in this country on January 8th. Wet Seal is closing all 171 stores that they have in 42 states. And American Apparel, they have all remaining stores of 110 stores will be closed. And we did an interview a number of years ago with an individual. And John, I'm going to have you play that clip because he was recently interviewed on FSN Premium. And a couple of years ago, he said 40% of all malls and retail establishments will disappear in the next 10 years. They won't survive. And that trend will accelerate with millennials who are more used to shopping online, and especially with their mobile phones. Let's go to that clip with Howard Davidowitz, one of the leading retail analysts in this country.
We have three times more store space per foot, per person, than any other developed country except China. In other words, we have three times more than England, Japan, France, Canada, or anywhere except China. So we're the second most overstored in the world, and most overmalled, and most over everything. Combine that with tremendous growth of online spending. This is a toxic combination. So you look out there, and what's going to happen is we're going to close tremendous numbers of more stores, more malls, because the whole growth is in online. So we're going to have to dramatically shrink size of store and store space. This is going to be traumatic because there's $47 billion of shopping center debt coming due in the next 18 months. We're going to see how that all works out. We have a lot of these private equity deals in retail. I don't know where they go. So there's going to have to be massive restructuring done in the retail space.
So then what are the implications for this? You know, he was talking specifically about malls. You know, as malls close, jobs close, and then there are also investment implications.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that are a consequence as of this. As you see, a number of these companies, retailers, are just simply going to go out of business. They're going to fold. They're going to go under. The other thing that you're starting to see, as Howard was talking about, there is a tremendous amount of debt that is coming due. And quite honestly, the owners of these malls are simply walking from them. A good example, there was a mall in Pittsburgh, and it was a big shopping mall. Going back to, let's say, 7 or 8 years ago, the mall was valued at $200 million. The owner of that mall walked away from the mall and basically said, turn over the mortgage to the bank. In this case, it was Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo took this over at $100 million. So it lost half its value. And you're seeing this with a lot of real estate investment trust in the commercial area. Rather than trying to rework their loans, refinance their loans, as we saw happen in the housing crisis, simply a lot of these REITs are just simply walking away and just turning over the keys to the building to the bankers. They're walking away. So you've really got to be careful if you're investing in real estate investment trust, especially in the commercial area, if they're in the shopping space, this is going to be a major problem area. And, you know, you've seen this over the years. Circuit City went under. You no longer see Circuit City. The Circuit City that went under closed where I live is now a grocery store. It's a health food grocery store. We saw Borders go out of business. I keep my fingers crossed that Barnes & Noble will be able to make it, because I don't know about you, John, a lot of things I like to do sometimes on Saturdays, I still love going to bookstores. You know, they have a Starbucks at the Borders here, and I can peruse the magazine section. I can see all the new books are out. And, you know, I don't know. It's just something that I love doing because I love to read. Simon Property, big real estate REIT, let one of their loans go into default. So more and more people are walking away from these companies. There was a giant mall in Texas. I forget which city. The owner of the mall walked away. The bank was stuck with it, just like Wells Fargo is stuck with this mall in Pittsburgh. And the bank just said that we need to do something with this. They sold it to a college. And so a junior college is going to be established and turn that mall, what was once stores, into a junior college. Be kind of cool. Be air conditioned, especially in Texas where they have a lot of humidity. But you're going to see more and more of this. And so you really have to be careful in the retail space. If you own large companies, I don't care if it's a Nordstrom or any of those, all these retailers are suffering. They're not meeting their numbers. And those that will survive, the only way they're going to survive is they're going to have an online presence. And I'll give you a good example of this. During Christmas, I went to Nordstrom's and I was buying my son some dress shirts and ties. And after Christmas, one of my sons said, Dad, do you mind if I take this stuff back? And I said, I don't care what you do with it. He took it back, got a gift certificate, went to Nordstrom's online where I had bought him four shirts. And I think four shirts and four ties. He got, I think, like seven or eight shirts, three or four pair of pants and seven or eight ties by going through Nordstrom's online. So he was able to buy these things at a lot cheaper cost. And this is what you're going to see in the future for those retailers that will survive. They will have a stronger online presence. Shopping malls are going to be much different in the future, because what's going to happen is the stores are going to be smaller. They'll probably have more kiosks. You'll go there to pick up stuff, but you're not going to see these big, big, large stores. The other thing, the implications for landlords of these malls is there's going to be some implications, because usually when you go to a large mall, there's a large tenant there. There's a Nordstrom's, a Sears, a Macy's. And then that also drives mall traffic to the smaller stores that are on the side. It's just like the automobile industry creates other industries, whether it's, you know, mechanic businesses, tire places. Well, the same thing, there's a ripple effect on with those smaller stores that are dependent on the big stores bringing in the traffic. Once that big store moves out, the tenants that you will have come in will may not generate the same revenues for the mall owner. So you might see a lot of these malls are going to be more based around entertainment, social events. They might have a movie theater. They might have a health club. They're going to have restaurants and things like that that they're going to have to bring in. But there's a lot of implications. A lot of this debt is going to end up getting default on. So you better watch the retailers that you're investing in, if you own them in stocks or you own them in an ETF. And also, if you own a mortgage REIT, you better look at what kind of mortgages they own. Are they mortgages on apartments? Are they mortgages on commercial space like office space? Or are they mortgages on shopping malls? And there's a lot of debt that's going to be coming through. A lot of these retailers are not going to make it. So, John, this is one trend that is going to accelerate in the future, because especially with mobile phone devices, Millennials are more used to shopping online with their phone than they are walking into a store. There's also one other implication of this is a lot of these stores, and you've seen this if you watch television or you get some kind of newsprint or magazine, a lot of these retailers do advertising. So this is going to affect local media revenues for local television stations during the Christmas season. A lot of these retail establishments are used to doing advertising. It's affecting the paper industry, the newspaper industry. It will also impact magazines and television in terms of media spending.
All right. And the next one is automation and the death of routine jobs. A lot of jobs now can be done by robots. They will require people with training to monitor and repair the robots, but it won't require as many physical bodies. Now, what's this going to do for the job market? I guess people are going to be wondering.
You know, we covered part of this in hour one. And the reason I had Matthias Cortez from the University of Manchester out of England, NIBR, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which tracks economic activity. They're the official arbitrator or pronouncement of recessions here in the U.S. They published a paper on automation. And it was very, I call it very scientific. It was one of the most difficult papers I had to read because people do not speak the way that these professors write. A lot of mathematical formulas, but I wanted to have him on, and I think he did a pretty good job. But if you take a look at what is happening, jobs that don't require high education, manual, that are non-cognitive, they're going to disappear. So if you think of manual jobs, routine jobs, all of that is going to disappear and it's going to be replaced by robotics and artificial intelligence. I mean, they are already doing this. Amazon is going to be using drones to deliver packages. And believe it or not, folks, you're going to see automated cars and robots deliver your groceries. Now, just to go to show you how this trend is taking place, in 1979, over close to 41% of the jobs in this country were routine jobs. By 2014, that figure had gone from 41% down to 31%. So a lot of things that can be automated, think of welding, bank tellers, grocery clerks, inventory stockers, restaurants. You're seeing this in the fast food restaurant chain take place where, you know, you can order your lunch through your mobile phone and you'll just simply show up and pick it up for lunch or even dinner. You're seeing it in the industrial economy. There are fewer manufacturing jobs today than existed in 2007, and yet the economy is producing more stuff today than we did 8 years ago because of robots making their way into the industrial economy. And anything that is routine work is going to be automated or outsourced. The remaining jobs are going to be low-paid service jobs, or they're going to be high-skilled knowledge jobs. And it's one reason it's contributing to what they call the labor participation rate. There was a story this week where corporations, artificial intelligence is making its way into the corporate world with IBM and Google. Technologies such as machine learning is going to play a bigger role in companies using artificial intelligence to automate work done by human beings. So they're also going to be using at the corporate level AI or artificial intelligence to aid in decision making. Take a look at what's occurring on Wall Street. Wall Street, a lot of the trading that takes place on the stock exchange each day is not done by humans. It's done by computers, algorithms that direct trading. So the vast majority of everyday trading in the stock market is done by machines, no longer human beings. There was an article this week that Siemens AG out of Germany is going to be using AI to automate and take its manufacturing into the digital age. So a lot of this stuff is one reason why we've had, and if you read the NIBR study that when I interviewed Cortez, he's saying a lot of these people, individuals, especially males that maybe did not get a college education, just a high school education, they're not adapting. And so a lot of them instead are choosing not to work. So hence, one of the reasons why the participation rate is going down. one of the reasons why unemployment is going up. So, you know, there are a number of things that are happening here. And John, it's one of the things that I think one of the mega trends that we'll be talking about is education, because education is falling short of helping individuals cope with a lot of these things that are happening as a result of technology. And if you are choosing education or in a profession, there was another paper that was studied. We don't have time to get into this. This was done by The Economist. And this is the probability of your profession being automated. Now, some good news here, if you're a professional athlete, they're not going to have robots playing baseball or football. That's probably good news. But here is where you're seeing the highest probability of a lot of the jobs that are routine being automated. In the health technologist, a 40% probability of computerization. Economist, 43%. Commercial pilots, 55%. I don't know about you, John. I don't know if I'd want to get on a plane, and yeah, I'd sure feel a lot better if I know there's a pilot in the cockpit. I don't know if I'm ready to get on a plane with a computer. Machinists, 65%. Word processors and typists, 81%. Real estate agents, 86%. Buyers will be able to go online, find homes, look at that, and negotiate. Technical writers, 89%. Retail salespeople, that's not surprising, given our first megatrend, 92%. Accountants and auditors, 94%. Telemarketers, 99%.
Well, when we look at automation, what do you think the sociological implications of all of this are? Because, you know, one of the things that people always vote is jobs.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the NIBR report, a lot of these males, both male and female, without these high-skilled cognitive skills that come with education are choosing not to work. They're dropping out of the workforce and just staying in unemployment. The second thing, and we'll get to this when we get to education, is the education system is failing these students, because what you have to do, you have to take somebody that has a manual job. Let's say that the job that used to be done at a factory, let's say you were on the factory assembly line, you put on a bumper, or maybe you were a welder welding things at a factory. Now you got a robot doing that. Well, in order to operate that robot, for example, Intel is building a new factory in Phoenix. It's going to be $7 billion, but it's only going to employ 300 workers, because a lot of the manufacturing will be done by robots. So the skill set that's going to be needed to, let's say, program and run that robot, you're going to need to have engineering skills. You're going to need to have computer science skills. You're going to need to have mathematics skills. They're entirely different. We'll cover this when we get to education. So the education system is going to have to change, because it's failing students. And it's going to be a societal ill that's going to have to be corrected. We're going to have to figure out a way to get these people that are losing these jobs as a result of automation into the workforce and educated, because it's going to take a higher skilled, more cognitively skilled individual to get these new jobs of the future.
One of the more curious phenomena that we're witnessing right now is what we're calling reverse migration, and the Central Corridor, of course, referring to the Central Corridor of the United States.
And this is taking place, I mean, for the longest time, you know, it was kind of like in the 19th century, he said, go west, young man, Horace Greeley. So, you know, you had this migration trend from the East Coast across the Central Corridor of the country to the West Coast. And we saw that, especially after World War II, in my own state of California, we have, what, about 11% of the population. The problem is, in these highly dense areas, one of the things that you have, the politics tend to be more liberal, the taxes tend to be much higher, there's more restrictions, there's more regulations, and the cost of living. I mean, the cost of living in California, for number one, California has the highest income taxes in the country. Our highest tax rate is 13.3%. We have high sales tax from 9 to 10%. We have high property taxes. And the cost of housing in California is 2.5 times greater than any place else in the country. And so as a result of it, in fact, just in the last week or two, we just lost another manufacturing plant, Nestle, which had its manufacturing plant here for food and processing food is moving out of state to California. We're seeing this trend. It's too expensive. The taxes are too high. The regulations are too high. And so people are moving in the areas of growth. You saw this in the election politics. If you looked at the map of the country, it was mainly red. Where you had the blue pockets of, let's say for Democrats, they tended to be on the East Coast and on the West Coast in these highly dense populated areas. And what you're having is people are moving out of these areas where the taxes are high, the cost of living is high, regulations are too high, businesses are fleeing. Where is Apple building its new factory? They're building it in Phoenix, Arizona. Where is Intel going to build its new factory? It's building it in Phoenix. You have companies that are building in South Carolina, companies that are building in Texas. And if you take a look at that central corridor, people on the East Coast, where it's crowded, it's more expensive, the taxes and things are higher, are pushing people to more what I call those states that have lower taxes, don't have the welfare system that they have to pay for, don't have strong government unions, and where it's cheaper to live, it's cheaper to run a business. And that is the next trend that you're seeing in population, where you're going to see a lot of these high dense areas is more and more companies move out of these areas with high taxation regulation. You're going to see them go elsewhere. And what's going to happen? What do people do? They go where the jobs are. So if Intel, Apple are building factories in Arizona, if financial companies are moving to Arizona, guess which state is going to be growing in population? Same thing with Texas. Same with a lot of, let's say, some of the southern states where you have lower taxes and a more business-friendly environment. So the next trend, John, is going to be reverse migration. I'm seeing it in my own state. Last year, we lost 100,000 taxpayers in the state of California, and we lost a lot of businesses that are just closing shop and moving where they can operate a business and function and live much cheaper.
All right. Next trend is something that's been constantly on our slate, reshaping energy and peak demand.
You know, it's amazing when we take a look at energy and we just go back to the beginning of the new millennium where we had oil prices in 1998 were $10 a barrel. By 2008, they were $150 a barrel. A lot of that had to do with peak traditional oil. In other words, you poke a hole in the ground and the well, the traditional type of wells that we were drilling. So traditional oil had peaked, and also emerging market demand as countries like China and India industrialized, it was creating this tremendous demand for energy. If somebody in China went from, you know, walking to a bicycle to a motor scooter to an automobile, that's obviously an energy consumer. And I still believe someday we will see peak oil of all forms, but I think it's probably decades away. But if you take a look at what happened after 2007 and 2008, U.S. shale oil production would take U.S. oil production for a little over 5 million barrels a day up to 9.6 million barrels, a figure that we hadn't seen since the peak of oil production in the United States in 1971. Horizontal drilling, fracking, all of this is changing the energy landscape. And we saw that noticeably in the trend in 2014, where U.S. shale production was coming online at such a rate that the price of oil began to drop. And typically in the past, OPEC would just cut production. Saudi Arabia would announce, we're going to cut production. And the price of oil, they would level the market and stabilize it. Instead, Saudi Arabia came to the conclusion, hey, if we cut oil production, everybody else will just take our market share. So Saudi Arabia chose instead to just keep pumping oil. And the result was in February of 2016, we saw the price of oil hit $26 a barrel. It's $54 a barrel. And I think there's a possibility that we're going to see some energy weakness here. But OPEC is no longer in the driver's seat as it once was. The swing producer of last resort is now the U.S. And since the U.S. is a market-driven economy, you can see energy ramp up, which is what we're seeing with drilling rigs being put into production since the beginning of the year. And it's not just that what we're seeing with the changes in shale, horizontal drilling, and fracking. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that was fascinating this week. Exxon is using supercomputers to improve reservoir mapping. They recently ran a simulation. You'll love this, John. 700, oh, I'm just going to round this off, 717,000 processors were used in a well reservoir, the equivalent of 22,400 computers were used in mapping out a well reservoir. So technology is changing the dynamics of energy production. OPEC, no longer the swing producer, that's now the U.S. And as we saw recently last year in the game of chicken, after 2 years, OPEC finally blinked and they extended, or they actually began to cut actual production. Now in January, we saw cuts of almost 900,000, which means OPEC is about 75% in compliance with their production cuts. But in order for oil prices to stay where they are in that $50 range, they're going to have to extend those production cuts beyond the first half of the year. And the prediction is they'll probably have to extend them into the second half of the year. So if you want to look at what oil is doing, it's trading in a $10 range where OPEC may be the floor for the oil market, in the U.S. may be the cap for the oil market. But something bigger is coming as technology changes how we drive and consume oil. We're seeing the advancement of hybrid cars, electric cars. And the IEA, in their one of their recent reports on their energy report, talked about instead of peak oil, they're talking about peak demand, which will take place sometime possibly in the next decade. I know I just got my first electric hybrid, and it allows me to drive to work, do all the shopping, do all the errands that I need to do. The car is operating on electric battery. I come home at night, put my little plug in, charge the batteries, and the power in my house is being powered by solar energy. So my house is solar powered. My car is battery driven. As this technology increases, I'm trying to think if it's Ford that just put out a car that can go from, it's either San Diego or Los Angeles all the way up to San Francisco. And I mean, it's kind of strange for me. This is the first time this week I filled up my gas tank. I got this car about 6 weeks ago, and I finally filled up my gas tank, John. And I just do it out of habit because I never let my gas tank get below 30%. When it got down to 30%, I filled my gas tank. I could have probably gone another 2 weeks without filling my car up with gas. So now, instead of getting a tank of gas or a tank and a half a week, I now get gas once every 2 months. Now think of more and more cars are going in that direction, what that's going to do. I have 3 employees that have electric cars or hybrids. So as electric cars take more and more of a percentage of the marketplace, we're going to see electric trucks, we're going to see electric trains. I don't know about jet fuel yet. You know, who knows what technology is coming that way. The implications are for oil companies and oil service companies and production. If you're investing in the energy sector, you're going to have to look at companies that can grow their production as a means of growing top-line sales, because in the past, especially in the last decade, a lot of these energy companies were able to rely on price increases as the price of oil went from 10 to 150. What do they do when energy is trapped in a trading range? The companies that you want to invest in are the companies that can increase their production. So they can't count on price increases to counter growth.
Education is going to be interesting because the face of education will probably start changing more and more. The cost of physically going somewhere to achieve an education, you know, physically going to a college, especially for postgraduate degrees, has gotten rather large. People are running up huge debts. The real question is, what happens if much of this could be done on the internet or through other means? So education, technology, and strangely enough, the age of guilds.
Yeah, if you take a look at college inflation rate for the last year, it was close to 4%. If you take a look at college inflation rates over the last 10 years, it's 5%. 20 years, it's closer to 6 to 8%. One of the big issues that we're going to be facing in the next decade is the $1 trillion of student debt. The average millennial couple that gets married today brings $70,000 to $80,000 of college education debt into the marriage. And it's one of the reasons why you've seen new household formations in the first-time homebuyer market has been less in past recoveries. Here's an interesting statistic. The college graduating class of 2015, just 14% of the 2015 graduates had steady career-type jobs, meaning 86% of the college grads, 5 out of 6, had zilch in the way of career prospects for postgraduate lives. And it's one of the reasons that the appeal of Bernie Sanders in last year's election is free college. You know, who wouldn't want free college? But stuff, free college costs something. Most degrees that a lot of these students that were graduating from the universities were irrelevant to getting a job. One of the articles, it was a major study on college grads. It was called Young, Educated, and Jobless. And the education paradigm that has been in existence since World War II, you know, junior graduates from high school, goes off to college, lives on a dorm, and then comes out of college and gets a high-paying job that'll pay more than a low-paying job or a less skilled job. The problem is, John, with the cost of education, most families aren't going to be able to afford it. According to a recent study, the average tuition for a private college is $31,231. That does not include room and board. For in-state college, $9,139. Out-of-state college, $23,893. And this is one of the things that you're going to see, and I call it the age guilds. You're going to see the rise of junior colleges that partner. It's going to be a public and private partnership where you have major companies like General Electric or IBM that are going to partner with a junior college, and they come up with, let's say, a two-year degree program or a one-year degree program that gives you sort of like a certification where you're going to be able to have the skills to go work in a modern factory today, where that skill is going to give you engineering skills. It's going to give you mathematical skills. It's going to give you skills in computer programming, because that's what you're going to need to run that $25 million robot on the factory floor. And you're also going to see the rise of online education and work. So instead of a family taking on massive amounts of debt or a student taking on massive amount of debt, you're going to see juniors stay at home, lives at home, and then has a job and works, and at night is going to an online education program through either a private college or a public college. So basically an online education instead of a brick and mortar education. What is going to happen to the education establishment with online is the same thing what online shopping has done to retailing. Online education is going to do the same thing to brick and mortar education institutions. And I have a client whose son got a degree, and with that degree, can't get a job. So he was able now to get a low-paying skilled job. So he is living at home and at night is pursuing another degree. He's going to become a medical technologist. So he's pursuing his degree online at home, living at home. So there's no room and board. There's no tuition. And the skill set that he's going to acquire in this new degree, he's going to be able to get a job in the medical technology field because he's checked with the occupation. And so this is going to change. And he's even considering going on to get a master's and a doctorate degree once he even gets his degree in the medical field. So he's not going to stop there. He's going to pursue additional education, either a master's or a doctorate degree. But Johnny's living at home. He's not incurring any debt. He's working in a job. And so this is going to change the whole education paradigm, because most parents cannot, let's say you have two or three kids, you can't afford to send all three kids at a cost of maybe $120,000 to $150,000 per kid for a private education, or let's say $50,000, $60,000 for an in-state tuition, or maybe $28,000 for an out-of-state tuition. It's just not going to work. So you're going to see the rise of trade schools where they're going to teach people with skill sets that they're going to be able to take that skill set and get a job, rather than the 86% of college graduates that have degrees that can't get them a job. So the internet is going to start doing to brick and mortar education institutions the same thing that the internet and online retailing, e-commerce, has done to brick and mortar stores.
Something we discuss quite frequently on Lifetime Income, which airs on Mondays and Tuesdays here at FinancialSense.com, is longevity and health. They're changing the whole scene of finances and retirement and other related issues.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at the statistics, longevity has been increasing by 2 years every decade. So if you look at a male age 65 today, his lifespan is 84.3 years. A woman age 65 is 86.6 years. One out of four age 65 individuals will live to age 90. One out of 10 age 65-year-olds will live to age 95. And you're seeing this advance. And we just don't have a lot of time to get into it. But if you have a chance, if you're at the grocery store or a bookstore, there's a special time edition. It's called 100 New Scientific Discoveries. And, John, everything from genetics to diabetes to mine to Alzheimer's disease to medical devices. Now, for those of you who are a health nut like I am and love to work out as I do, you probably have, I don't know, you may have a Fitbit, or you may have an Apple Watch that tracks your calories, your number of steps, your heart rate. Folks, wait till you see what's coming out in the next 10 years. You're going to have medical devices that are going to monitor your body functions in your vitals. So if you have diabetes, you'll have a device that will control your insulin and the production of insulin in your body. You're going to have, if you have heart disease, you'll have a monitoring device that will be recording your heart rate, your blood pressure, and your heartbeats, and it'll be storing it and sending it to your doctor. You could be out in the bush in Africa somewhere. So, you know, these health devices that we see right now are nothing compared to what you're going to see in the next 10 years. And good news for those of you that have heart disease in the family, I have a good friend and a client who's a cardiologist. He said, Jim, just tell your clients to stay in shape as much as they can, because the medical advances in heart disease in the next 7 years are going to be mind-blowing. So this is something that's going to happen where, John, you're going to see not only people live into their 90s, but we're going to have a lot more centenarians. And, John, this is going to have dramatic changes for Social Security in retirement. You're going to be working longer. That's a trend that's taking place now. Social Security is going to have to be changed to keep it solvent. You cannot be allowing, just as they changed it for you and I, John, as boomers, full retirement benefits at age 66 for Gen Xers and millennials at 67. You're going to see the retirement age on Social Security move to age 70. I know the politicians aren't telling you that now. I know it's coming because I have contacts in Washington. It's there, but what do politicians do? They wait until they're in a crisis and then they act. But because of longevity, because people are living longer, the age of Social Security and retirement is going to be pushed back. 40% of men age 65 are working today instead of retired.
Now we come to something that a lot of people have been concerned with. We are all aware of the book, the novel that George Orwell wrote, 1984. And are we entering into Orwell's world? More and more we're hearing that our rights don't apply in certain areas. More and more various arms of government have the power, or even the private sector have the power, to monitor practically everything that we do. And we see a very disturbing trend on, especially on college campuses and academia, to mandate what it is people should think or not think, say or not say. So are we getting into something that's really ominous here?
We are. And this is something that should concern anybody living in a Western country with democracy. We're seeing the rise of fake news, where you have rumors that become headlines. For example, there was a tweet that supposedly came from General Flynn, and there was a news conference where he called himself a scapegoat, and it turned out that was a fake news item. It wasn't a tweet. You see today in news a lot of hyperbole in terms of news stories or the way an issue is covered. You also have with political correctness is a form of mind control. And if you haven't read Orwell's 1984, I highly recommend you pick up a copy, and you'll see a lot of the similarities to what you see happening today. On college campuses, John, you talked about the intolerance to diverse views. Colleges used to be a bastion of free thought. Today, they're becoming a bastion of intolerance. We saw the eavesdropping on General Flynn. Look, folks, if they can eavesdrop on General Flynn, who had a cabinet appointee, and then release that out. Imagine what the government can do to you and I. We saw, for example, with the leaks coming out from WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden. And then we also found out about that giant NSA and information processing center in Utah with all these supercomputers. I mean, let's put it this way. And then in 2009, the NSA had to admit that it was over-engaged in data collection on U.S. citizens. Folks, your phone calls, your emails, and your text, your social media is all being monitored by the government. And here's something you probably didn't know. Your phone, well, you probably know this, can be used as a tracking device. They can find you just like the GPS in your car. What you didn't know is your phone could be also turned on without you knowing it as a listening device. And this thing that really, really struck me, John, and I don't have them in my home, and I won't use them because it's too Orwellian for me. But go into a Best Buy or a store and look at the TVs that have the cameras on them. Because remember in Orwell's 1984, the individuals that were living in society had TVs in every room, and the government could monitor what you were doing. Well, they're already monitoring your phone calls, your emails, and your text. So imagine what they're going to be doing in the future. There's a book and a movie. I interviewed best-selling New York Times author Brad Thor. He wrote a book. It came out in 2015. It was called Blacklist. And I read it during my August recess. And it was one of the scariest books I read. The government can do this stuff. And sure enough, within the 12 months, a lot of the stuff that Brad Thor wrote about in his book came out in the news. So the book is called Blacklist by Brad Thor. The other movie I'm sure many of you have seen is Enemy of State with movie star Will Smith. And I think it was Gene Hackman that starred in that movie. And, you know, it was amazing. As I take a look at, you know, what I used to read. In the 80s, I read the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. And then in 1991 and 92, I spent about a year and a half doing television news. And one of the largest databases I used for television news was the New York Times. But the thing that really struck me, I walk away, I'd go home each night to my wife, and I say, look at all these stories that are out there that we're not covering. And I used to print out these stories, and I saw the way the news was shaped, how it was biased, and it's biased in many ways, the way the story is presented, the information that is left out, and more importantly, the stories that are not covered. John, you've done news for what, 30, 40 years? I've been doing news since 1987, but haven't you seen this transformation in the news?
Yeah, starting in about the 80s, we saw the run-up to it in the 70s, the shift in the journalism and broadcast news departments of colleges began to teach their students that they could be social activists, and that was more their job than to just report the news. And that's why we see today, as a result of that, you began to see, first of all, the media and the main media in the country moved leftward, and then talk radio came along, followed by the internet and podcasts, and they went rightward. And as a counterbalance to that. But today, with the social media, the difficulty that we have is very few people get complete stories because they're not hearing both sides of the story. They're even suspecting as being wrong the other side. And so everybody's just listening to those things which reinforce their own worldviews.
Yeah, it was amazing. There was a book out, and I highly recommend you get it. It's called Gray Lady Down. And it's by William McGowan. I interviewed him. The book came out in 2010, and it's Gray Lady Down, and it's what the decline and fall of the New York Times means for America. And he talked about the New York Times was once considered the gold standard in American journalism and probably the most trusted news organization in America. Today, it is generally understood to be a vehicle for politically correct ideologies, tailored liberal pieties, and repeated victim of journalistic scandal and institutional embarrassment. In fact, it was just recently announced their subscription and readership has gone down so much that in the New York Times building, they're leasing out 8 floors. And we saw this also with the Washington Post. I mean, the Washington Post at one time was worth tens of billions of dollars. It was sold to Jeff Bezos of Amazon for $250 million. So a lot of the news that is covered today is biased in the way it is presented, and also it is biased by what is not shown. And believe it or not, folks, they still shape the way you vote and the way you think. And this is something, John, I think that it ought to concern everybody when it comes to liberty in terms of the Fourth Estate. Will it really survive, or will it simply become a propaganda arm of government as in Orwell's 1984? And we're seeing more and more trends that the media is becoming Orwellian than they are the Fourth Estate as an independent check on government itself. And this is a trend, hopefully, that can be arrested, but it is nonetheless a dangerous trend.
Okay, and that covers the seven megatrends. We will be discussing in the future an eighth megatrend, but we have to go into it a lot more in depth in a future program. Coming up next on The Big Picture, the next crash. When does the market going to turn? When will things go down? Active versus passive investing. All of that as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Pavlova or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Here's a flashback from the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, recorded earlier in the week.
One of the things that we talked about is how much emotion hurts our ability to think rationally. And one of the studies I cite shows that we lose 13% of our IQ in a period of great emotion. So how much more our decisions around the money colored by emotion? It's very, very dramatic. It was a study that was looking at how people appraised the value of something, in this case, wine. And so they put people in these whole body fMRI imaging apparatus, and they gave them sips of wine. But before they gave them the sip of wine, they showed them how much the wine cost. And then they measured the reactivity of their brain to this. And so they found that the quality of the wine basically had nothing to do with how much people liked the wine. But the price that they were told it cost had everything to do with how their brain sort of processed the enjoyment of it. So price shouldn't have a great deal of influence on how we view value, but it does, which is, you know, just the opposite of what you want to be doing in the stock market, of course.
Now, we are going to talk about bull markets. Ta-da-da. Welcome back to The Big Picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Pavlova and John Loeffler with you. Every bull market has its own characteristics. We might sort of plot along the lines that Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. In the 1990s, it was tech stocks. In the 2000s, we saw the emphasis on commodities, on real estate, on mortgage bonds and credit default swaps. The current bull market is focused on robo-advisors and passive investing. And the whole cycle of bull markets followed by recessions and market downturns, believe it or not, no matter how much politicians would like to promote the idea, have not been repealed by government. If you recall, Jim, the Soviets tried to block that, saying, well, that's a capitalist phenomenon and we should be able to smooth all this out so we don't have the upsy downsies. Well, they still had the upsy downsies, comrade. They never got around it. So we need to look at these characteristics of markets.
Yeah, one of the things that is reshaping the retirement market, especially for a lot of boomers, is boomers. I mean, John, if you take a look at the stock market, it went up almost every single year in the 80s and the 90s. From 1995 to almost 2000, the stock market was going up double digits a year. So a lot of boomers quit saving. I mean, why save when the market was going up 15% a year? The problem is, between 2000 and 2002, the stock market lost 45% of its value. If you were in tech stocks like the NASDAQ, you lost 70% of its value. Well, voila, 5 years from 2002 to 2007, 5 years, the stock market goes up. People went into real estate, commodity investing, gold, silver, commodity type stocks, mortgage bonds, credit default swaps were the rage in the hedge fund industry and institutions. And that bull market came to an end at the end of 5 years. And between 2007 and 2009, the stock market lost 45 to 55% of its value, depending on where you were invested. So the thing that we want to emphasize here, because we're 8 years into this bull market, bear markets have not been repealed, nor have recessions, despite all the euphoria now over the Trump rally. We are going to have another bear market. And, I mean, just take a look at the number of bear markets we've had since the end of World War II. Right now, if you take a look at market valuations, they are the second most expensive market in history. With the latest rally, we went from the third most expensive to the second most expensive. And the thing that you need to understand about this, and this is what we've seen with how individual investors are investing, especially after the second bear market between 2007 and 2009, a vast majority of investors went into bond funds, they stayed in cash, or even worse, they bought gold, thinking that gold was going to 10,000. And what really drove this bull market has been corporate buybacks, which have been averaging about $500 billion a year, and also central banks buying stock, like, let's say, the Central Bank of Japan. So it has been more institutionally driven companies in central banks than it has been driven by individual investors. As I mentioned, the vast majority, just judging by where the money went, judging ETF flows and mutual fund flows, were cash, bond funds, or precious metals. And we know that bull markets have three phases to them. The first phase, the second phase, the final phase. The final phase is characterized by euphoria. Remember what it was like in 1999 and 2000, or what it was like in 2006 and 2007. And, you know, we're tracking money into equity ETFs and bonds. Money is flowing out of bond funds because of the rise in interest rates from the summer of last year, when interest rates got down to 1.3 and ended up the year at 2.6. So a lot of people in bond funds gave back all their gains and some lost money. Now, with the rally and records being set by the Dow, money once again is flowing into equity funds, equity ETFs. And like usual, the public is chasing returns. Well, probably the most popular ETF is the Spiders, which represent the S&P 500, or the Diamonds, which represent the Dow Industrials. And what people are not doing, and this is a real concern that we have, is there are measures of risk that are used in the industry to measure how risky your portfolio is, how risky your ETF is, how risky your, let's say, mutual fund is, or your entire portfolio. And what people are not looking at, investors are not looking at, is risk-adjusted returns. You have things like beta that measures how volatile your stock or mutual fund or ETF is. You have measures such as the Sharpe ratio, which relates to a return on investment or portfolio. It relates it to the degree of total risk taken. You have things like the Trainer Index, which are closely correlated to each other. In other words, the Sharpe Index relates returns to total risk. The Trainer Index relates return of an investment portfolio to the degree of systematic or market risk taken. You have the Jensen Index. There are a number of things that measure alpha and other things, but more importantly, what is not being done here is investors are not looking at the risk that they're taking for a rate of return. And this is a tenet of Warren Buffett's that he's long held for many, many years in his entire life. And one of the reasons he's the second richest man in the world. And basically, he likes predictable companies. So let's say you have two investments, two companies. One company, A, averages 12% earnings growth over a 10-year period. Company B averages 12%. They both have made 12% over a 10-year period. But company A has steady earnings that rise each year at 7, 8, 10% a year. They've been steady. Company B, on the other hand, has earnings that go up 30% in 1 year, 20% in the other, down 40% in 1 year, and in the next year up 10%. In other words, it's more erratic. And so that's what investors are not looking at. They're getting into something, not realizing the risk that they're taking. And we do know that bear markets, I mean, there's systematic risk. And there's unsystematic risk, which is basically the risk of the markets. And what happens to investors so many times is they throw caution to the wind, chasing returns. And we're seeing this with mutual fund flows and ETF flows, as John Kosar and I talked about in hour one. And you contrast that prior to the election of Donald Trump, when the markets were more erratic, especially at the beginning of last year, where we saw the markets head down 6 weeks in a row, then they went up, then they went down ahead of Brexit, then they went up during the summer, then they went sideways and down ahead of the election, and then took off after the election. And we've seen this caution in these choppy markets, which investors tend to do. When the markets are choppy, unpredictable, more volatile, investors get more cautious, more conservative. When the market is going up week after week, as we've almost been doing since this election took place, now investors are getting more euphoric. And here's the psychological thing that you have to think about. As human beings, we are 2.5 times more concerned about fear of loss than we are about gain in our investments. And the problem is, investors are investing in ETFs, they're going into mutual funds, they're going into stock indexes, various indexes, and they're not realizing how much risk that they're taking. And it's one of the things that advisors try to do. If you have a good advisor, you have a risk questionnaire that you take, or you might have a target risk. And what you're really trying to do here is assess your own risk tolerance that you personally have. What are your true feelings about risk? What amount of risk are you willing to take? And unfortunately, a lot of planning today is done with these 100-year models that show that stocks earned 10% over the last 100 years, bonds 5.5%, and treasury bills 3.5%. You're lucky to get 0.5% on treasury bills today. You're lucky to get 2.4% on a 10-year treasury note, and you're lucky if you can get 10% a year on stocks. But the last, let's say from the year 2000 to the year 2016, the rate of return on stocks, which mainly came from 2013 forward, has been 5%, not 10%. So this is the thing, John, that really concerns us, that we're seeing. And I'm reading in the statistics, and one of the things that we use to gauge market risk is the degree of euphoria. Personally, I don't think this bull market is over, but I think that this bull market run that we've seen since the election is probably closer to the end of that run.
Well, okay, you look at risk. Why don't you give me an example of what you're talking about?
Well, one of the examples I had is we had a couple come to us in January. We're putting together a retirement plan for them because they're getting ready to retire here in the next couple of years. Now, this couple had, mainly the husband, had $2 million in his 401k program. A lot of that, he worked for a defense contractor. A lot of that came from his own contributions matched by the company. And that's not counting what he had in individual stocks. And we did a risk questionnaire, and it was an extensive questionnaire. And heading into retirement for this couple, their risk was measured in terms of a scale of 0 to 100. Their risk was close to 25. Then the next thing that we did, and they were feeling pretty good. They thought that, you know, they were going to be able to retire. He planned on retiring at age 66. They would get full Social Security benefits at that time. And they felt pretty good, and especially about their rate of return in the markets, especially with the Trump rally and especially with stock returns over the last couple of years. What was amazing is their risk profile was 25, and basically we loaded their 401k into our program that judged the level of risk he was actually taking, in other words, how he was allocated in his 401 portfolio. And his risk in his portfolio was closer to 65, or 62 was the actual risk number, versus his own risk, which was closer to 23. Now, what we had to do is we had to put this in numbers, and we basically said, your upside potential, given market characteristics and how you're positioned, is a 22% return, meaning you could make another $400,000 on this portfolio if everything continues as it is. However, your downside risk is 17%, meaning you could lose close to $350,000 on your portfolio. And basically, they said, we couldn't afford to take that risk. That would set their retirement back several years, because the plan was hoping that, you know, they would have this $2 million or hopefully more, because the plan was to retire within the next 18 months. And so basically, the way his portfolio was positioned versus his risk and his ability to absorb risk was entirely different. And this is what's happened. This is what often happens in a bull market. You know, we're 8 years into this bull market, and, you know, he's feeling pretty good because the last couple of years and the Trump rally has been good for his portfolio. Unfortunately, he didn't realize the type of investments he was allocated in were very, very high risk. And we basically said, you know, look, which would you rather have? Would you rather roll the dice and assume everything works out perfectly and you can make another 20% here in the next couple of years by the time you retire? In other words, another $400,000. Or do you want to risk losing $350,000? And, you know, obviously, when we pointed out the risk, so as a result of his plan, we've made modifications to his 401k plan and get it more in alignment, especially for somebody that's getting ready to retire in the next 18 months. So the point we're trying to make here is you need to have a plan, an investment plan. You need to know your own personal tolerance for risk. Your advisor can't tell you that. Only you yourself can tell you that. And the thing that you need to do, and this is very, very important, I can't emphasize this so much, you need to stick with the plan. If your risk requires that you have maybe 50% in bonds and short-term bonds, and only 50% in stocks, you don't switch that just because President Trump got elected and the stock market has been going up every single week for close to 2 months now. Imagine what it was like at the beginning of 2016, where the stock market was going down every single week for 6 weeks in a row until the Fed changed its policy in February. And instead of raising rates four times, they only ended up raising rates one time. And so this is the thing. If you're out there, you're looking at, you're turning on the news and you're saying, oh my goodness, the stock market made another record this week. You know, if you are 10 years away from retirement, 5 years away from retirement, or in retirement, folks, do yourself a favor. If you have a plan, stick with your plan. Don't let your emotions get the best of you and start chasing returns. We see this, we call it the magazine indicator, where every single year in January, you take a look at the most popular fad investments that worked in 2016, or the most popular investments that were advocated for 2017. And you saw that in January when I went to the bookstore and got all the financial magazines and predictions for the year. They were all recommending emerging markets, stock funds, and recommending reducing bond funds. And guess what? That's exactly what investors do. And so this is something, don't let your emotions rule the way you are investing, because I can tell you this, we're 8 years in this bull market. We will have another recession. We are going to have another bear market, and especially now that the Fed is in the rate raising mode, because we know we've had 13 presidents since World War II, 11 recessions in bear markets, and they've all occurred in a Fed rate raising cycle. They were preceded by one. We're in a Fed rate raising cycle now. What do you think eventually is going to happen?
If we look at something practically, how do you handle risk with your clients?
I mean, one of the things that we do is we begin with a financial plan, a retirement plan for most of our clients. And we also begin with a risk questionnaire so that a client, not us, but the client defines their own risk levels. And it's one of the things that we have to remind them. We have a plan. This is your risk. We need to stick to that plan. You can't be a risk taker 1 week and then be a conservative investor the next week. And so we take a look at that, and then we assess, as I did with this client that was getting ready to retire. So we had to make some adjustments in that portfolio to align it with the risk. Now, a lot of times, we'll keep things in a portfolio if they're working. I mean, I had a client that had Apple stock. You know, we kept the Apple stock because it was a stock that we were owning for a lot of the things that we were doing. So we kept that stock because it was working for the client. So as long as things are working and it fit in with the overall portfolio of risk, we keep that. But more importantly, what we try to do is get the client to focus on what are your goals, what's your time frame for achieving these goals, and what is your risk level? And because unless you know that, John, you can't be successful in achieving those goals. You can't be going back and forth between conservative investor versus gambler. I mean, and this is what you see. It is a prescription for a disaster. And one of the things that we've seen in this fad, in this bull market, is there are a number of myths out there. One, it's always a good time to invest in averages. Well, guess what? Averages, yes. If the stock market is in a bull market, if you were in an index fund, you will match the market returns. But conversely, if you're in a bear market, you will match the market downturn. If the market and the S&P lose 45% of their value in a bear market and you're in an index fund that mirrors the S&P, you will lose 45% of your value. And unfortunately, most people don't get out. They don't ring bells at market tops. It's a process that begins. And one of the things that's very deceiving about this, and this is very important for you to learn as an investor, the market indexes that we follow, the NASDAQ, the Russell, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, are market cap or price weighted. And this is the thing that fools so many investors towards the end of a bull market. The market is still going up, hitting new records. But what is happening is because the way the index is put together, the large cap stocks make up a larger and larger portion of the index. Another way of saying it, it's a handful of stocks that is driving up the index versus a large swath of stocks in a wider index. And this is what fools investors. They don't realize the market is topped because the index itself is going up to a higher level, but there are fewer and fewer stocks that are driving it. And this is what catches most investors by surprise, that the bear market has begun, but they just don't know it.
So if we were to come up with a final summary here, number one, have a plan. That's a start. Number two, know your own risk. And number three, stick with your plan and don't follow the herd, especially what the blow dries are saying on the financial channels. That's why you have a plan, to give you a reference point as the waves of the changes keep pushing back and forth. You have some idea of where you should be navigating. So all of that in a time of, well, what are we looking for? Changing markets again.
Absolutely. And I think, once again, 2017 is going to be like 2016. It'll be a first half story and a different second half story.
Well, as we always say at this part of the program, what is coming up in the weeks ahead, which is of concern to us?
Coming up in the month of March, which begins next week, the Fed will be meeting in March. Probabilities of a rate hike have now gone from 20% to 40%. So I'll be watching that. Also, we'll be watching in the month of March, in the middle of March, any company warnings on earnings. We'll be watching our companies saying, hey, we're going to meet our earnings estimates, or are we going to basically fall short of our earnings estimates? So we're going to be getting into the pre-earnings season game, which will begin next month, which begins next week, as a matter of fact. And we do have a Fed rate hike. And of course, we got all kinds of stuff and no shortage of things to talk about going on in Washington. Will they repeal Obamacare? When will we get the tax cuts or the tax reform bill? All of that. So this is going to be a very exciting and I think a much more volatile year for investors. Right now, enjoy the ride. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.